Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The most expensive house race ever is over, and it turned out to be a big win for Republican Karen Handel, President Trump, and the GOP. The special election in Georgia's 6th district left Democrats empty-handed, Republicans reassured. With all the talk of resistance, it's the fourth loss for Democrats in special elections for House seats this year. This hour on Point, the message of Georgia's 6th. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Republicans, Democrats, what do you take from this battle? Was John Ossoff the wrong guy for the Democrats? Does the Trump brand still sell? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's go right to Georgia's 6th. Joining me now from Dunwoody, Georgia, is Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What did it boil down to, Greg?
Well, the turnout was just eye-popping. More than 260,000 people, far surpassing any previous special election we've ever had in this district, turned out to vote. And, you know, the ads may have backfired. There's more than $50 million spent in this district. It might be even closer to 60% when it's all accounted for. And of that total, $42 million at least were spent on ads. And, you know, voters here just got fed up. They were tired of watching all the negativity.
Did Ossoff succeed in pulling over a bunch, some Republicans?
He probably did. Most polls showed him with about 10%. But the number I kept on hearing from Republicans and Democrats is he needed to get at least 15%, maybe even higher, to end up swinging the district. And we're not certain yet if he got that. We'll be pouring through the numbers we've got over the next few days. But it looked really, really tough for him to do that, especially when there was such a high turnout. Because frankly, there are more Republicans in this district than Democrats. So the higher turnout ended up helping Karen Handel a lot more than helped John Ossoff.
So in the end, it was Karen Handel by 52% to the 48% for Ossoff. That was a lot closer, I guess, than the last time you had a full-on run there. What was it? Didn't we see a 20-point lead?
It was. Tom Price has won that district by landslide margins since he was elected in 2004. But also, don't be fooled by the fact that it was just 4%, because that's actually a lot wider.
Well, that's a healthy win, for sure.
Yeah, it was a very healthy win for her because, I mean, polls had showed either him up or it being deadlocked. So the fact that she won by 4% and that it was over before newspaper deadlines last night, I mean, there were people out of there by 10:30. That's how quickly we were all expecting to go into Wednesday morning. That showed you that just how far apart the two were in this race.
I guess my point is just that a 4% victory, while quite a healthy victory, is not nearly a 20% victory. But then, as you say, $50 or $60 million thrown in here should change things somehow.
Yeah, I mean, and Democrats are quick to point that out this morning too, saying that they've narrowed the gap in a district that Tom Price won with 62% of the vote just in November. That being said, they also
pretty slim consolation.
Yeah, $30 million in spending, and the entire national spotlight being on this race, where in November 2018, when Karen Handel runs for re-election, there'll be a lot less attention on this race because there'll be hundreds of other races around the country.
We've heard all the make nice kind of comments that both the winner and the conceding John Ossoff have made in the wake of the results last night. But let's hear how they were talking in the heart of this election. This was Ossoff, 30 years old. He was talking here with WXIA in May, describing why he wanted to work across the aisle, seek out different viewpoints, kind of moderate tone.
Politics has become ugly. There's so much partisanship out there. But I think this campaign is bringing people together by focusing on core values, by focusing on our local economic development, That's why the campaign has built a coalition that goes beyond merely political party.
Bringing people together, core values, a kind of moderate, hey, come and work with me message from the Democrat. Here was a Republican, Karen Handel, going after him hammer and tongs, saying, look, he doesn't have the resume, he doesn't live in the district. Here she goes.
He's a junior staffer who inflated his resume. He rarely mentions the fact that he's a Democrat. His campaign is powered, you've heard him say it, by Nancy Pelosi and liberals from California, New York, and Massachusetts. He says he lives 5 minutes outside of the district. Well, that's fine, but his values, they are 3,000 miles away.
And boy, did she bang on that theme. How did that play ultimately, Greg?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a significant factor in the election. We talked to voter after voter, who mentioned the fact that he didn't live in the district. It was one of his biggest liabilities.
He grew up there, right?
He didn't live in the district. He was transparent about it. He when he broke the story, he was running to me back in January. He said it, but still, that didn't make up for the fact that he did not live in the district. It was something that is basically pummeled. It was used as a battering ram against him.
I mean, why not? Why did he think he could win in a district he didn't live in? He grew up there? Is that right? Was that supposed to be enough?
Yeah, he grew up in the district, and he said he'll move back to it. But his fiance is attending medical school at Emory University, which is just south of the district, and has been walking to work every morning for her shifts. And so he said he wanted to support his fiance because she supported him so long, and that he didn't want to. He was standing up for her rights. Now, that's great and all, but it still opened him to an attack from Karen Handel, saying, "How can he represent this district if he doesn't live here?"
Yeah. What about the messages? What did she hammer on? What did he hammer on?
Yeah, well, she realized, of course, that there's more Republicans in the district, and that really her path to victory was just consolidating Republican support and getting GOP turnout. He had a much more arduous task because there's a lot fewer liberals in the district than Republicans. And so his strategy was to wring every vote he could out of the Democratic core. But also, he had to appeal to moderates and independents who might otherwise vote for the GOP, but were disgruntled or alienated by either Handel or Trump. And that's why you saw this kind of not as sharp attacks on Trump. At the beginning of the campaign, he talked about how his victory would make Trump furious. But by the end of it, Trump would visit, or Mike Pence would visit, and he wouldn't even lay a finger on them. It was just a unique way of taking. He would not do red meat attacks. He would just talk about Washington figures visiting Georgia without naming them by name.
Is Trump still popular there? I mean, the New York Times is calling you where you are, Dunwoody and Roswell next door there, the Lululemon and Loafers subdivisions. Very well healed, that part anyway. How's Trump's popularity there?
This is an establishment. This is about as establishment-friendly district as you can get. It's very well-educated. Very affluent, a lot of high household incomes and big homes, and they were very skeptical here. Republicans, especially of Trump. It's a district that Marco Rubio easily won, and frankly, I kind of see it as them skeptical because the establishment, the status quo, is kind of working for a lot of the people in this district. So they're not that eager to shake it up. So it's a district that Trump only won by less than 2% of the vote, even though Romney and McCain easily won this district during their presidential campaigns. So they were torn over Trump, but I think in the end, they also supported the overall GOP agenda, and Karen Handel was able to effectively argue that a vote for her would be a vote in favor of that Republican agenda.
I noticed last night, she did thank President Trump, but she didn't thank him using his name. Here she was.
And a special thanks to the president of the United States of America.
Okay, and no name. So do you see this as an endorsement for the president? He was quite vociferous in supporting her, tweeting for her, coming on down. Does this say, and we'll ask Eliana Johnson, who joined us in just a moment from Politico, but do you see from your seat there in Atlanta, does this say, hey, you can roll President Trump out and campaign on him with him and you'll be fine, GOP?
I think that's exactly what it says. I think one of the reasons Republicans were so eager to pour a lot of resources into this race was to show that a Handel victory could also buoy other jittery incumbents who were worried about how competitive they could be in some of these districts. And Handel aggressively tied herself to Donald Trump after she notched a spot in this runoff. I mean, at the beginning of the campaign, she was not one of the pro-Trump loyalists. There's 11 Republicans in the first round of voting, and she was not one of the more ardent pro-Trump Republicans. But after she got her second place finish in April, she told me the very next day, of course I'll be seen with Donald Trump. Of course I'll be campaigning with him. And within a week, there was a fundraiser for the two of them. He was sending tweets in her favor, and she has backed pretty much every single one of his top priorities. The only issue that she's really raised about him was his tweeting and budget cuts to the CDC, which, of course, is based in Atlanta, and there's thousands of employees of the CDC who are in the 6th District. But other than that, they're closely aligned.
Go easy on the tweeting, Mr. President, and don't cut jobs here in our district. Greg Bluestein with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Stand by. Eliana Johnson is with us, national political reporter for Politico, joins us from Washington. Eliana, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What do you make of this?
You know, I've sort of been pouring cold water on the people who are trying to project, draw conclusions from this and project it onto 2018.
Okay.
I think, it was a special election. Special elections are special. There were millions and millions of dollars spent on this race, the most expensive in history. And there isn't going to be a race in 2018 that's like this. And so every Republican I talked to for our story today really cautioned Republicans about being too optimistic about the outcome of this race and being optimistic for the 2018 midterms as a result of it. Many of them pointed actually to the 2009 race in New York's 23rd district, where just a year after President Obama was elected, the establishment-backed Republican candidate dropped out of that race. Democrats won, and it really obscured how much trouble the Democratic Party would have in the 2010 midterms, where they lost over 60 seats. Republicans took back the House. So many of them were worried that Republicans would be too cheered by the outcome of this race and not realize what a difficult landscape 2018 will be, where the incumbent party historically loses many, many seats.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the big vote in a special election in Georgia's 6th District yesterday. They're the sound of cheering, jubilant Republicans as Karen Handel entered her campaign headquarters last night in Atlanta. Karen. She took the victory 52-48% over John Ossoff. Here he was last night saying, though he lost, the fight goes on.
So this is not the outcome any of us were hoping for. But this is the beginning of something much bigger than us.
And you can hear supporters cheering there 2018. He had more to say. We showed the world we could do it where they didn't think we could, but we didn't quite do it, but showed the world we could fight.
And we showed the world that in places where no one thought it was even possible to fight, we could fight.
Yeah. And lost in an election that was the most expensive. All 50... Greg Bluestein with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution with us says maybe $60 million in a special election just to fill out a portion of the remaining time of the seat of Tom Price, who has joined the Trump cabinet. Greg is with us from Dunwoody, Georgia, in the 6th District today. Eliana Johnson is with us, national political reporter for Politico. She's been watching all of this, as have eyes across the country. People pay a lot of attention to this. You can join us this hour. How do you think the Republicans won it here? Was John Ossoff the right challenger with the right message? Just couldn't be done. Was this a referendum on Donald Trump, the president? What's the outcome mean in that regard? And what's it going to take for Democrats to win nationally, district by district, if they're going to win in 2018? Lots of questions and comments for the two of you. Norcross, Georgia, Michael is calling. Hi, Michael, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to bring up gerrymandering. I don't know if it applies in this particular case. I haven't looked at the district lines for the 6th to really know how they look. But as far as the national picture, I know back in, you know, the 1800s and stuff, gerrymandering probably wasn't that big of a deal just because the, you know, your room for error was there. But now with modern technology, you can get the districts drawn down so, you know, specifically that I don't know if the Democrats really stand a chance in 2018. And then that means the Republicans will control again. 2020 will happen and they'll redraw the district lines. And here we go again.
Michael, I get the concern. There's been a lot of talk about it and a lot of lines redrawn and redrawn with very meticulous attention to who would be voting where. Let's go local first and Eliana for the national view here. But Greg Bluestein, what about in the 6th district? Was gerrymandering an issue here? Does it look like some kind of crazy gargoyle or not?
Well, there's no doubt this district was drawn for Republican, and we've even quoted Republican officials saying this district was drawn for Republican. It is, and the demographics overwhelmingly favor Republicans, and that's why Democrats here in Georgia are so focused on the 2018 race for governor, because they hope that if they can somehow win that open seat, that they can help control the redistricting process that will come in after the 2020 census. But I will say this. The district had been redrawn after the last census to include parts of North DeKalb, which are the bluest parts of the district, and really the only parts of the district, the only reason why this district was competitive at all, because that's the territory that Ossoff won by almost 60% last night.
Eliana, what about our caller's concern that nationally you've got districts drawn so helter-skelter, gerrymandered, that Democrats can't get around that? Is that a legitimate fear?
Sure. I think nationally, the gerrymandering, it does favor Republicans. But what we saw in Trump's election is, I think, is a political realignment start to come underway. You know, we've seen disruption in many industries. And I think Trump's election was the beginning of a disruption in politics where many Obama voters crossed over to vote for Trump. And so I don't think, you know, what many people once defined as a Republican is necessarily a Republican voter now. And what many people once defined as a Democrat is necessarily a Democratic voter. And so districts that were once gerrymandered for Republicans, I think this election tested, would Republicans vote Republican and would Democrats vote Democrat? That will be tested, I think, in the 2018 midterms, in 2020.
More crossover coming, or the possibility of that, Eliana?
Well, we certainly saw that in 2016 16, with with Democrats crossing over to vote for Trump and vice versa.
Yeah, Tom in Buffalo, New York. Tom, you're on the air.
How you doing? Being from Blue State Buffalo, but also having lived in Marietta for 2 years
in Georgia. Yeah,
this was Newt's seat. This was Saxby's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to say that we were going to win this is pie-in-the-eye stuff. Also, the number one employer in that area is the United States government. It's military base. But nobody talks about that.
Well, are you talking about the 6th District or beyond?
No, in the 6th District in Marietta, the number one employee is the United States military. So it's hard for us Dems/liberals to actually combat all this nonsense.
What
stupid does.
Well, you got some fairly successful people there in Georgia's 6th district. I don't know how stupid exactly, but Greg Bluestein, you know, what about the argument that, look, there was just no way Democrats got themselves all charged up and spent a whole lot of money in a spot where this was not going to happen? It's just too deeply Republican.
Yeah, and that speaks to the argument that Ossoff's best chance was in the first round of his vote when there was 18 candidates in the race. It was April 18th vote, and Republicans were divided. The Handle was one of the top fundraisers, and she had maybe $500,000 under her belt.
Yeah.
Ossoff had already raised $10 million+.
He came so close. He was almost hit that 50% mark.
And the fascinating thing is he got the exact same margin. He got 48% of that vote and 48% last night. So for all the money and attention spent, he did exactly the same performance he did in April.
Don in Charleston, South Carolina. Don, you're on.
Yes. There was a similar race in South Carolina. not in Charleston, up near York County. It's getting very little attention. It was actually a little bit closer, and it was, I guess the Democratic Party didn't think they stood a chance. They didn't spend any money on it to speak of. And it looks like...
this is where Ralph Norman won in the 5th Congressional District there, yeah.
You're right. He may have done better by just the local man running on his resources than getting the National Party involved.
Eliana, how about it? Did the Dems put the big chips down in the wrong square here?
No, I don't think so. You know, the Democrats, it's noteworthy that the Democrats performed pretty well in both districts. The Georgia district, Georgia 6, is an R plus 8 district, and John Ossoff lost by 4 points. Tom Price won this district by 23 points.
Yeah.
I don't think it should be lost on anybody that, you know, this district went 61% for Mitt Romney. It's a hugely Republican district, so the Republican margin of victory here has been eroded not only by Donald Trump, but also by the fact that they didn't run a great candidate. And the Republican margin of victory in South Carolina district was hugely eroded as well. So Trump has certainly been a weight on the Republican Party, I think. But it's also true that Nancy Pelosi and National Democrats have been a weight on their party. And they just it wasn't enough to counterbalance the Republican margin in the district. So there are crossover voters in the district. You know, there wasn't an 8-point margin as there historically has been. But the anti-Trump fervor isn't enough yet. Whether it will be in 2018, it's certainly a possibility.
Greg, I know we have to let you go. Of course, this will come back up and soon because this is a special election just for a portion of a term. Do you see Democrats making a big run at this again? Or was that so expensive and didn't work out? And, oh, no, thank you next time.
Yeah, I mean, Ossoff has a big vexing decision ahead of him because he could run for this seat again. He could run for statewide office. I mean, this is a guy who's spent $30 million, essentially, from him and other Democrats to support his campaign. So he's got tremendous name recognition across Metro Atlanta now. My hunch is he'll run for the seat again. I don't think he'll run for statewide office. I don't think he'll sit it out in 2018 entirely. But he has said that he has to talk with his fiance and his friends and family before he makes up his mind.
Maybe move into the district next time. Greg Bluestein with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in Dudworthy, Georgia, in District 6. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Eliana Johnson with Politico in Washington. Stand by. I want to bring in a Democratic strategist, a Republican strategist, pollster. Anita Dunn is with us, a Democrat, managing director at SKD Knickerbocker, a public affairs firm in Washington, works with a lot of Democrats. Anita Dunn, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very well. And in Alexandria, Virginia, Glenn Bolger joins us, Republican strategist and pollster, partner and co-founder at Public Opinion Strategies. Glenn, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you take from the Georgia win for Karen Handel, Glenn Bolger?
Well, a couple of observations. One is Republicans, you know, we have reason to feel good. You know, when you're outspent by $8.5 million in the most expensive congressional race ever and still pull it off, you know, that's a great sign of teamwork between the different arms of the party as well as the candidate. On the other hand, I would not draw too many conclusions about next November. I looked at data yesterday that if you go back to 1966, to midterm elections, when the president's approval is below 50%, on average, his party loses 40 seats in a midterm election. So, you know, that's a scary number. At the same time, look, Democrats have to show that they can start winning somewhere, and they have not.
Anita, it's been a string of losses in special elections. Democrats were really hoping for that big "we'll show you" victory in the 6th District in Georgia. What do you make from the outcome?
Well, I think Glenn made some important points here. I think we all love to put a huge amount of attention and analysis into special elections. It's often hard to see them as real predictors of anything. But if you
why did Democrats spend $30 million then,
you know,
Anita?
And it's a darn good question, Tom. I think people will ask, especially given the fact that for much less money, they've been getting roughly the same results in the other four special elections that were also in very red districts, some much redder than this one, and still getting roughly between 45 and 48% of the vote, which is, of course, the good news for Democrats, which is in these very red districts where they picked House members to move into the cabinet because they knew they were safe districts that they would not have to worry about losing. The Republicans have ended up having to spend a huge amount of money. But I also think that we shouldn't overlook the fact that the Democrats haven't won in any of these districts as well as they have done, and that clearly in order to regain control of the House and regain control of the Senate, we're going to have to actually go beat some Republicans, probably in some places that Donald Trump carried. So both parties are going to carry lessons out of this. And, you know, the next round of tests are going to be the gubernatorial elections this fall. And I think that you'll probably see a lot of action from both sides, from both parties in those as well.
Eliana, it's not optional to win in places where Trump won in the presidential election. The Democrats must do that, right, to have any hope of taking back the majority in the House next fall.
Absolutely. They need to pick up some of those seats. In fact, the Georgia 6th district, you know, the reason it attracted so much attention is because it's a district that Trump won by 2 points. He's not particularly popular there, but it's a heavily Republican district in general. So it's precisely districts like Georgia 6 that Democrats need to be able to pick off if they're going to win the House next year. And I do think that this race last night, it showed the limitations somewhat of the anti-Trump message and the limitations of, you know, what the Democrats are calling the resistance, of running on the resistance. Karen Handel, you know, it would have been very scary for Republicans had she lost, because she ran away from Trump. Trump and Pence came down to do fundraisers for her. They helped her by raising money, but she refused to appear in public with them. Mike Pence was down there last week. She had held a closed door fundraiser, but she would not use the president's name in the closing days of the election, and she would not appear side by side with him in public.
Evan in Chamblee, Georgia. Evan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I live in the 6th. I've lived here most of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm actually very encouraged as a Democrat by not by the fact that we lost, but I think it's really important to understand the on-the-ground structure that was rebuilt in Georgia, which has been ignored by the National Party for so long. This kid, this 30-year-old kid, knocked 19 points off of the Republican lead for this seat. 23 points Tom Price won by. He lost by 4 points. That's astonishing. And it built an incredible on-the-ground structure that is not going to go away. And so I think the Republicans have plenty to fear and the Democrats have plenty to cheer about.
Are you discouraged, though, that with all that and with all the money, he couldn't make it over that final few yards to take the victory, though, Evan?
Of course I'm very discouraged, but Ossoff had a very positive message, and so I don't think it wasn't what the party did. It wasn't anything he did. This is a gerrymandered district, and it is highly Republican, and Democrats had a 4-point spread, you know, 2 points more and 2 points more in the primary, and he would have won flat out. So, yeah, we're disappointed as hell, but the fact of the matter is it's a very strong reemergence of the Democratic Party in this part of the state.
In a deep, deep red district. Evan, I appreciate your call. Jim in Newton, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on. What do you see?
It clearly was, to me, a referendum on Trump, because the most dramatic part of Handel's speech last night, which you'd left off when she said she wanted to thank the president, although she didn't mention his name, right after that, the crowd went, Trump. And I think if you played that part of the clip, I know it's all the media, they just say he didn't mention his name, but they leave out the part right after that where the crowd spontaneously goes in Trump, Trump, Trump.
No, we heard it, Jim, and there's no curtain over it here. Who should I take this? Glenn, was this a referendum on Donald Trump, even though she soft-pedaled his name during the election, didn't appear in public with him, as Eliana says?
Well, let me make a couple observations. One is special elections, as somebody said earlier, are special, called special for a reason. And yes, they are somewhat significantly a referendum on the president, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's Barack Obama, George W. Bush.
Yep.
You know, going back, the president, it's like a by-election in British politics, where it is not just a local vote, it is a vote on how people feel about the direction of the country overall. Secondly, you know, the Democrats are crowing, and we heard one of the callers say this, that, yep. you know, he did 19 net points better than the last Democrat did against Tom Price. A couple observations. One is incumbents generally usually run stronger than open seat races. Open seat races are sure. much closer. Secondly, the Democrat in that race spent around $1,000, which is a little bit less than the $31.2 million spent on behalf of Ossoff. So, yes, the race was going to be closer because it was an open seat. Republicans are in charge of Washington, and, you know, the party in power usually gets dinged.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Republican win in Georgia's 6th District, the one Democrats really wanted, and the electoral map for the vote ahead in 2018. Eliana Johnson is here, national political reporter for Politico. Anita Dunn is with us, Democratic strategist with SKD Knickerbocker. Glenn Bolger is here, Republican strategist and poller with Public Opinion Strategies. Handel said, look, been a lot of guys here. She's the first Republican congressperson, or she will be when she takes office. And she talked about those who came before her, Newt Gingrich, from Newt Gingrich to Tom Price.
These men, these statesmen, have created very, very big shoes to fill. And I will do my level best to live up to the standards that they have set.
Democrats' teeth set on edge there with Newt Gingrich and Tom Price. First woman Republican elected there, but she tips her hat to the men. John Ossoff tipped his hat to the women in his concession speech last night.
At a time when politics has been dominated by fear and hatred and scapegoating and division, this community stood up. Women in this community stood up. You did. And you picked this campaign up, and you picked me up, and you picked Alicia up, and you carried us on your shoulders.
Okay, and the Republicans won. But this is rolling forward to 2018. There's going to be so much action there. Lots of people paying attention already to House Speaker Paul Ryan's district in southern Wisconsin. You've got Randy Bryce, Democrat, challenging him there. Army veteran, iron worker. Here's from his new campaign ad.
I'm the best person to represent this district because I'm a working person. If somebody falls behind, we're so much stronger if we carry them with us. That's the way I was raised. You look out for each other. I think it's time. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C.
Let's trade places, Paul Ryan. I don't think Speaker Ryan has too much iron working in mind. You can join us this hour. What do you think? What's it going to take for Democrats to win nationally, district by district, in 2018? And who should be running? What should they be saying, believing, the Democrats, the Republicans, in next year's contest? I want to welcome Matt Taibbi to our conversation. Journalist, contributor to Rolling Stone. His piece in the Rolling Stone lately is "The Democrats Need a New Message." Matt Taibbi, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think of what we just saw and what the Democrats ought to be pushing to win in 2018?
I mean, I've been saying this for a while now, you know, just based on my experience covering this campaign and several previous presidential campaigns. I think the Democrats need a fundamental rethinking of who they are and what their brand is and what their message is. I think, obviously, we understand that gerrymandering is a serious problem, but when I go out on the campaign trail and I talk to people who don't live in big cities and aren't college educated, to me, the Democrats are just not competitive with a certain kind of person. And I think that's a serious problem, and it's a big change in the party's profile. You know, going back, if you talk to people like Bernie Sanders, he talks about when he grew up, you know, he grew up in a poor neighborhood and everybody was a Democrat. You don't see that so much in particularly in white working class areas. They just don't have a message, and they're perceived as a party of cosmopolitan upper middle class to rich liberals who have nothing in common with these voters, and that's a serious problem. And no amount of money is going to overcome it. And until they become a party of actual working people, and I think, you know, having an iron worker run, I think that's a great idea. They're going to continue to have these losses.
Does that mean Ossoff made a mistake? I mean, after all, Dunwoody and Roswell there in Georgia 6 described again as Lululemon and loafers subdivisions, not exactly white working class.
Well, I don't know how much to blame Ossoff personally. I just think that this is going to be a long process. I don't think this is a thing where they're going to go into one election and suddenly turn things all around. They need to go back decades and rewrite the history of who they are. They're just not perceived right now as a party that advocates for middle class and working class people outside the cities. And you know, that's just an observation that I make as somebody who interviews voters all over the country every time we have a national election. And I think that's going to take a generation to fix, or at least a while.
Eliana Johnson, do you see the Dems, especially after these losses in the special elections, in a kind of internal struggle, civil war, heading toward November 18, about what the message should be, sort of moderate, middle of the road, or more Bernie style?
Well, I think Matt is absolutely right. And I think Donald Trump, in many ways, was not a cause, but a symptom. What was his message? It was the elites are stupid and out of touch. And who were the elites he was talking about? Hillary Clinton was an embodiment. Bankers, Wall Street, you know, he decried any of that, all of them, even if he now has put them in his cabinet. And Bernie Sanders, I think, pointed many of these things out about Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I think Trump was symbolic of the disruption in politics of the exodus of white working class voters, embodied in many ways by Joe Biden, from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, and of many of the white collar elites from the Republican Party, embodied in many ways by Mitt Romney, now into the Democratic Party. And it's the Democratic Party that has become at least perceived as the party of elites, and the Republican Party that has become perceived as the party of the working class. And Trump is a symptom of that. So I think Matt's right about that. And it's a problem that Bernie Sanders is pointing out, but that many Democrats, the resistance, in I think, is symbolic of this. Many Democrats are resistant to hearing.
Ironic when you see the billionaire cabinet that Donald Trump has put together, but not entirely ironic because, of course, that characterization of the Democrats or Democratic leadership, part of it is not entirely wrong. Anita, I'll put it to you. Let me get a couple calls here first. Deanne in Decatur, Illinois. Deanne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to hear what your strategists have to say about the theory that Democrats are their own worst enemy. And by that, I mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi is competent, but she polls terribly nationally. And since she's from a coastal region, as Matt pointed out, I think that turns a lot of people off. Democrats had an opportunity to elect new leadership, and Nancy Pelosi should have stepped out of the way, or the Democrats should have insisted on a new face. There were a lot of good candidates from the Midwest, which if you had put somebody like that into the leadership role and taken Nancy Pelosi out, you wouldn't have her as a liability or at least a campaign issue when the Democrats run in the fall.
Deanne, let us pick it up. Of course, yes, Karen Handel put a big bullseye on Nancy Pelosi and then threw that bullseye around John Ossoff, and she won. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to you, Anita, and you, Glenn. John in Austin, Texas. Josh, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is Josh in Austin, Texas. A Republican in a very Democratic city for sure.
Okay.
I think a big problem with the Democratic Party is they just don't listen to their people. You know, in the main election with obviously Donald Trump and Clinton, they didn't listen to their people that wanted Bernie Sanders. They did everything they could to keep with the Clinton name, and they just, I think it shows in these elections too, is they're just not listening to their people. They're not putting forward the people that they want to have elected, and I think that's a huge majority, and the reason Republicans are winning is because they're putting forth a candidate that is actually listening to Republicans.
Josh, I appreciate your call as well. Anita Dunn, do the Democrats have a messaging problem here? Do they have a split kind of screen message? You know, the Clinton squad, the Sanders squad, do they have a listening problem?
Tom, a few quick observations. One is that I think it is important to take a step back here and note that what we were talking about is a failure of Democrats to win special elections in five safe, deep red Republican districts. So that would be my first observation, and that the midterms next year are going to have a very different dynamic because those do tend to be a referendum on the president and the party in power, and even low-information voters in this country know who's running things right now. So at the end of the day, we have a long way to go before the midterms. But I think that the focus on Nancy Pelosi actually does raise a deeper problem for the Democratic Party, and it's one that Matt talked about in his comments, which is, you know, she is a symbol of things that, of underlying issues that clearly voters in this country have problems with in terms of the party. So it's not Nancy Pelosi per se. If it wasn't her, it would be somebody else. But the real question Democrats have to figure out as we move forward here is really what are those underlying things that people really do have a problem with in our party? Is it our approach? Is it how we talk? Is it how we listen? Is it more fundamental than that? And I do think that the Democratic Party has to have a positive message, an alternative message to what the Republicans are offering, and that 2018, as much as it will be a referendum on the party in power, we also need to have an alternative. So people like Seth Moulton, who are raising this issue today, I think have a very valid point. Yeah.
Glenn, you're there in the Republican camp. What are Republicans hoping how the Democrats will resolve this internal conflict over messaging and where they stand? Would you rather see them go moderate or go progressive, go Sanders' direction from a Republican perspective, Glenn?
Well, let me just say, in terms of what we've been talking about, I'd like to wish Nancy Pelosi much health and long life, because she, for us, is the gift that keeps giving. In terms of what Democrats ought to do, we've got enough problems figuring out what we ought to do. So I don't know that, you could argue this one and say a little more passion, a little more Bernie would be a good thing. You could also come back and say, you know, they've got to, that's not going to appeal to independents who are not voting for them, and that's tough. What I would point out real quickly is politics is a pendulum, and, you know, it swings in one direction and then turns around and goes in the other. So while Democrats are trying to figure out, you know, what they need to do to fix their problems, Republicans have to keep that in mind and stay on their toes and work hard and get things accomplished, if they don't want to be punished in 2018.
Matt Taibbi, do you see the Democratic Party leadership or rank and file working this out before we get into the heart of the 2018 battles here? Or is it going to be a kind of, cognitive dissonance, divided message party headed toward the midterms?
Yeah, I don't think the party has seen its bottom yet. I think they need to have another catastrophe before they realize how bad things are out there for them. I mean, just to tell a quick story to illustrate what Anita was talking about before, about how Trump is a symptom, really, of what's wrong with the Democrats. I remember sitting with union members in New Hampshire, and while they were listening to Trump, and he was up there basically just saying, look, neither party is going to get your job back. They've been lying to you for decades. I'm going to do this and that, and those jobs are going to come back. And these people were like, well, you know, we'll go for him because the other two parties, we don't buy them. You know, in other words.
The other two, but he was a Republican in the end.
Right. Well, he's not, but they perceived him as not being part of the either structure. And that's why they chose him. The Democrats are so totally disbelieved and implausible with that kind of voter that they'll even make that kind of choice just sort of on a lark because they think it's better than nothing.
You think they'll do it again, though, a year and change from now, after President Trump's been there for a couple of years?
Maybe not. And of course, Trump is probably going to see a hit, you know, in the midterm elections. But the Democrats need to do something better than run against Trump. They have to come back and they have to figure out who they are and they have to find a way to appeal to ordinary people, which they just don't right now.
Eliana Johnson, do you see Democrats uniting around an approach to that challenge?
I don't. I think there's going to be a lot of party warfare on both sides. In fact, Anita mentioned, the need for Sorry, lost my train of thought there. But, you know, the need for a positive message. And I think it's as much of a problem on the Republican side as it is for the Democratic side. In many ways, I think it's a bit overemphasized in the sense that I don't think Republicans have a positive message right now. And they eked out a victory in the presidential election, you know, by tens of thousands of votes. And the conversation on the Republican side had Trump lost would be, what do we stand for? Who are we?
Sure.
And in many ways, I think it's as important a conversation for Republicans to be having right now as it is for Democrats.
One more call from Georgia. Charles in Stockbridge, Georgia. You're on the air, Charles.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, good. I'm a progressive Republican, and I've really been paying attention to this race, even though I don't live in that Republican politically gerrymandered 6th district. The Democrats had an uphill battle to start with, but as I watched this, what terrified me was that millions of dollars that people poured into that Ossoff campaign from all over the United States shows how much people hate, you know, the lies and the distortions that come out of the Trump administration, I'm sorry to say. And the bad thing about it is that while Republicans maybe won this election, when they get to the 2018 midterms, I think they're going to take a horrible beating. To give you an example of how desperate they were for the long time that this race was going on, House Speaker Ryan's GOP PAC that provided money to support Karen Handel's race showed nothing but Black Bolt rioting the day of Trump's inauguration. It showed street fighting in Aleppo. It showed pictures of Bernie Sanders and Pelosi and kept saying that John Ossoff, who really didn't vote for any of this, who was not in Congress, and who had a good deal of experience working as a congressional aide, it just it really painted him terribly. And this was the whole series of ads that continually ran all throughout the election up till the final days. I'm afraid that whatever Republicans may think that they've won in this victory is going to come back and just hit them in the face.
But progressive Republican, Charles, you might be the swing vote. Would you have voted for Ossoff if you were in the 6th?
Yes, I would have. Huh. I certainly would, because I don't think that the trickle-down theory of Koch brothers-backed funding that you've seen horribly destroy the state of Kansas's economy is going to work, you know, for what Donald Trump wants to do and with the administration, with their cutbacks in health care, with their
Charles, we'll take that as a last word from Georgia, and we're glad for your call. Thank you so much. I want to thank all of my guests in this hour. Eliana Johnson at Politico. Thank you, as always, Eliana. Thank you very much for being with us. Matt Taibbi with Rolling Stone. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Glenn Bolger, Republican at Public Opinion Strategies. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
And Anita Dunn at SKD Knickerbocker. Thank you, Anita.
Always fun to join you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.